Podcast. It is Wednesday, October the 9th. Thank you so much for tuning in today. As always, the show is brought to you by the patrons of the show, patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Head on over there to get more information. But basically, this show takes time. This show takes money. This show costs money to publish. This show costs money for the Zoom H4N Pro recorder that I have purchased. This costs money for the Skype account. This costs money for the microphone. So there's a variety of different things that go into this. And then also the time. My goodness, the time that goes into this. I do love doing it. But it does take a lot of time. And it does take a lot of energy. And coming up with new and creative ideas and finding different interviewees around the world. What's cool is people are starting to come to me, which is a nice change. I've got so many interviews lined up in the month of October. I was just looking. I think there's 6, 7, 8, there might even be 10 that are scheduled over the next 4 weeks to happen, which is really, really cool. So you'll be hearing lots of stories coming up. And today is a hell of an interview, one of my favorites. I actually finished it and I was laughing and we're already talking about doing a second part of this. So before we get to the interview though, I want to make sure that I give a special shout out to Holly, Christina, Ross, Caroline, Julie, Casey, Brian, Sarah, Adrian, Alyssa, Stan, Sarah, Kristen, Arnie, Barb, Kim, and Helen. And so these are all people that have made some kind of a monetary donation into the show on Patreon. You can go on there. I think there's a level as small as $8. There's somebody that's donating $35 per month. So everything that you can contribute helps. I think you might even be able to set your own amount if you want. A few bucks in the tip jar helps keep the lights on, helps keep this podcast around. Certainly, obviously, there is an incentive involved in continuing to put these shows out. But at the end of the day, it still does take time and energy. And so if you don't feel like monetarily supporting the podcast, iTunes reviews or Facebook reviews are also very much appreciated and loved. So today's an interview with Julie Markowitz. So Julie is a psychotherapist in the Northeast currently. However, by the time that you hear this, she's only a few weeks away from her big move to San Diego, where she's going to be taking on clients there, but can also do it remotely. And so she's going to be taking on new clients here coming up in the next few weeks. And so you'll be able to find her at juliemarkowitztherapy.com. I think one of the more fascinating elements that this type of a medium can take on are people that have gone through it as a patient and now are actually treating it. Dr. Schubiner falls into that category. Certainly Dr. Sarno falls into that category, but Jim Prusak falls into that. Mike Murray falls into that. So there's been a ton of interviews over the last couple of years that I've done where people sort of go in as a patient and then they exit as a practitioner. What are the different things that worked for them? And then they start applying a lot of those principles in. And Julie's got a really unique story, unique approach, and a vastly different one from the ones in the past. There's a lot that goes into this particular interview, and it certainly could have been one that went 2 hours or 3 hours or maybe even more. So we're discussing getting a second parter up soon. So I don't want to sit here and babble on for a long time to lead us into the show, but just know that this is a killer interview, and Julie, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Again, juliemarkowitztherapy.com, and you can find the direct link in the show notes. So here's Julie. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. My name is Eddie Lindenstein, and I am here with Julie Markowitz, who presently is calling out of New York, but she'll be off to sunny San Diego in a few months, moving to the other side of the coast. Julie, are you there with me?
Hey, Eddie. Yeah, I'm here.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. And it's also really nice if a practitioner reaches out to me and says, hey, I've got a story to tell, and I love that kind of stuff. And so I'm really excited to dive in and learn about your story as a practitioner. But I want to start because you had mentioned, I mean, you've got a chronic pain story of your own. And I think one thing that's interesting when people come on here and tell their story is sometimes it's the, you know, a back pain or neck pain. Sometimes it's different, but everybody's story is really different. And even if yours seems really unique, there's probably somebody listening right now in Japan or could be anywhere across the world. And they're going to identify with your story. So maybe kick us off there. Kind of tell us really where your origin story, as I always like to say.
Okay, so I had mind-body symptoms from basically the time I was born. I had two autoimmune diseases. One almost killed me, actually. And then I developed chronic pain, like what we would call fibromyalgia, by around age 10. And so that was something I was just kind of always dealing with. I started getting massages when I was like 11 or 12. So I always felt that my life was just chronic pain. And then lots of other symptoms, like really depressed, a lot of anxiety. And those were things I was always trying to deal with. I put myself into therapy when I was 15, but nothing really seemed to help me. I just was kind of managing a really difficult experience. And I wondered if things ever could get better for me or if therapy worked at all. And by the time I was in my mid-20s, I had a lot of life changes going on. I was planning to leave my job and go to business school, and I was getting married. And then I developed severe abdominal / groin pain. And I went to a bunch of doctors, and then someone diagnosed it as a sports hernia. They said I tore my rectus abdominis. I've always been pretty physically active. I was a figure skater. I power lift, but I wasn't lifting at that time. So then I had an operation, and I thought everything was going to be better. I felt better, at least on the area of my pelvis that had been hurting. And then suddenly, my anxiety shot through the roof, and I started having pain on the other side. I had pain down my leg, pain all over the pelvic area. It was really horrible. I had never been in pain like that before. I had always just been in pain, but this pain felt different to me. It caused me such horrible anxiety. I was not functioning. I was going to different doctors almost every day. I was in PT. I can't tell you the number of specialists that I saw. And I started trying to look into alternative methods. I saw a hypnotist. I did acupuncture. And it's interesting because my acupuncturist had said to me, you know, pain like this is generally caused by repressed anger. And there's this guy named John Sarno. And I did not want to hear about it. I thought that he was calling me an angry person. I thought he was crazy. So that was early in the summer of 2012. Then by early 2013, I had made my way to a nerve surgeon in Washington, D.C., and that surgeon said to me, maybe you should see a pain therapist. And I said, I already have a therapist. But he said, no, someone specifically about the pain. So I had gone down this route a few months earlier and called someone, but they refused to see me without doctor clearance. So I decided to just Google pain psychologist NYC. I found a different therapist who was willing to see me. And then he said that he wanted to help me. He said that he thought that my pain could go away. And that was very helpful. And also at the same time, I was terrified. I thought that just like everyone else with TMS, that I must be different.
I want to back up and just get some clarification. Yeah. When you had that initial surgery, this is before. So when you had like pelvic pain on one side and then you had a surgery and then your anxiety went through the roof. Did the anxiety go through the roof because you woke up from the surgery, or not even necessarily woke up, let's say in the corresponding days, weeks, and months afterwards? Is it because the pain didn't change, didn't shift? Like, is that where the anxiety continued to shoot up? Was it like related to pain, or was it more of like a symptom imperative?
I think it was a mix of both, because on one hand, the pain that I originally had went away, but I developed new pain.
Gotcha. Okay. No.
Worst pain, actually.
Yeah. And it just because everybody describes this kind of stuff really differently. And I feel like somebody recently talked about like the McGill, I can't remember what it's called. I think it's for primarily pain doctors, physical therapists. I think primarily that's what it is. And then maybe some chiropractors, but it's like the McGill chart or scale of pain or something like that. And there's a few different buzzwords or descriptions that people use for theirs. I guess, how would you describe it? I mean, was it a electric shock? Was it a pinching? Like, how would you describe what that pain felt like?
the new pain in my left leg down kind of my whole groin was an electric shock plus like throbbing. I'm trying to think what else. It was just so intense and so horrible that I couldn't sit. I couldn't walk. Every time I took a step, I would feel a pulling and then an electrical shock. It was just the worst feeling that I could possibly imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. And then this pain. So the pain, maybe I didn't catch it, but the pain psychologist, how did you find him, or how did he find you? How did that relationship come together?
I Googled pain psychologist NYC.
And then, you don't have to share the person's name, but, I mean, was that, cause one thing I feel like I see all the time on, more so like in Facebook groups, is that people are kind of like damsel in distress. Like, oh, I can't find somebody that addresses this stuff. You just did a Google search and found it. So what was it? was it difficult to find somebody, or?
So as I said, I was in therapy for almost my whole life.
Yeah.
And all of my therapists were awful and didn't help me at all. And they kind of acted like I was a lost cause.
Yeah.
Which just made the problems worse. What happened was, and I've mentioned my therapist's name on Nicole's podcast, actually. His name is Dan Ratner. I hadn't seen him listed as one of the TMS practitioners before, but he is. And it was just kind of, it was almost like winning the lottery, I think, that I called him and he treated me kindly. I had never met anyone that warm and empathic and that said they wanted to help me before. So that was really different. It was awful for me to find a therapist. I don't know how many therapists I've had in my life, but the number's over 10, and Dan just treated me very differently than everyone else, and I decided immediately that I wanted to work with him, and I tried to trust him that he knew what he was doing. At that point, I think he had worked with about 10 TMS patients.
Awesome. Okay. Did you ask anything, like, because sometimes I think that people get a little hung up on their own symptoms, and so if they're trying to look for somebody particularly, yes, like a pain psychologist that can help them, it's like, oh, how many people have you worked with that have this thing, even though you know now, and we're going to get into this later, that thing doesn't necessarily matter.
So I do know that now. At the time, I did not know that because I had had such horrible experiences with therapists. I walked in and I told him all of my symptoms, I was very suicidal. I had had an eating disorder for 15 years at that point. The groin pain, the full body pain, the anxiety, and I just listed all the symptoms and I said, have you worked with these before? And I was particularly curious about the groin pain because I decided that many other TMS patients, my pain must be different. It's not back pain. I have back pain, but that's not why I'm coming to you. He told me that he had worked with groin pain before, but he, like most practitioners, kind of said, it's all the same stuff.
Right. Which at that point probably is like the worst thing. Like, you don't want to hear that. You know what I mean?
He told me the pain was going to go away. I didn't believe him, but I also tried to hold on to a slight hope that this person actually knew what they were talking about.
Right. Okay. Well, let's go. Keep going on the story.
In terms of what happened after that?
Yeah. Chronological.
Okay. So I started seeing him. This is in April 2013. I tried to understand how to get rid of this groin pain. We talked about, and this is the approach that I generally use with patients, even though I've kind of adapted it and made it my own, but it's, here are the feelings that cause TMS. And so the feelings are anger, sadness, fear of emotional closeness, feeling helpless, feeling burdened, like you have to take care of everyone, and doubt, which I now describe as having some kind of internal conflict. So I tried to think about all of the ways that those emotions came out in my life. And I did journaling about it. Just what I tell people to do and what I did was think about a time you were having pain, when it got worse or it was less, and think about what was different about that time, what happened before, what were you thinking about, and then trying to identify the feelings. Because generally, the reason why we're having symptoms is because we're so out of touch with our feelings. So I spent probably, I remember having my first breakthrough in pain July of that year. I had gone on vacation and really did some thinking about what my thoughts and my behavior and what was causing this pain. And I noticed that there was a pattern of goodism, trying to serve everyone and being completely out of touch with my own needs. And then I'd say the pain kind of almost completely resolved by the fall. And then that was the main thing I was worried about. But then what happened was, once the pain went away, I started feeling a lot worse emotionally.
Interesting. So that's like, and that's something Steve Ozanich talked about a lot in his book, is that, you know, the pain went away and then suddenly his like anxiety and depression shot through the roof.
Yep.
And then it's a whole new set of problems. And Dr. Hanscom told me the same thing. And I think I even asked him, if you could pick between the two, this excruciating pain that you had or this anxiety and depression, he said he would pick the physical pain every day, which is tough to say when you're in physical pain, right? To say, hey, I'd rather pick this other thing. But what year are we in, by the way, this time? Because you said July.
This is still 2013.
2013. Okay.
Yeah.
So the physical pain starts to lessen, but then the emotional pain starts to shoot up. So talk about that emotional pain a little bit.
Sure. So I think what's important to mention is that I didn't know this until later in my journey, but I have complex trauma, which means that I had early developmental trauma because my parents are not particularly available. They have had a lot of trauma themselves that they haven't dealt with, so they didn't know how to take care of their children. So there was no space for me to be my own person with my own feelings or anything, really. So I had a lot of pain about that because I didn't know how to be a person, a functional person.
Right.
So it ended up being that I had a lot of self-hatred. I had very negative thoughts about myself. I didn't know how to connect with other people. So I just internalized all of this pain into thinking that I was the worst person alive.
Yeah. And that's what was going on when you're talking about the elevation of the emotional problems. It's that.
I think I got more in touch with it. I was feeling really out of control. My therapist was telling me things that I didn't want to hear about, that I had choice and I was independent. And, I also had pretty bad dissociative symptoms. Are you familiar with that term?
I'm not. I was just about to ask, what is that?
So what happens when we have trauma, specifically as children, is that we have no escape. So we normally would fight or flight, but in response to that, we freeze. So dissociation is a freeze response to when you would normally need to fight or flight. And because you're trapped as a child, there's nothing you can do. So that response gets integrated into how we deal with things as adults. So when I would hear things that would frighten me, which weren't actually necessarily things that need to frighten me, but saying that I was independent or had choice, I would just completely psychologically leave. Like, I didn't live in my body. I never felt connected to it. So I also think maybe the pain was a signal about that.
To pay, hey, like basically tapping you on the shoulder or like punching you in the face and saying, hey, pay attention.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess keep going with that. Cause did you get a bounce back between kind of these, like, is it almost like a teeter totter where you would have these emotional issues but the pain would lessen? Did you have a revolution of that where you hit a 180 and the pain came back, but the emotional issues went down?
The pain would come back periodically. The emotional issues did not go away. They were very front and center for many, many years.
Yeah.
And I was in so much pain emotionally. I hated myself so much. And that's kind of where I operated. Just this isolated self-hatred. Everyone hates me. I'm totally alone. That's like how I lived all the time.
What did your therapist, were you still working with that therapist at this time? So what was his feedback on this like sudden shift from having, you know, this excruciating pelvic pain into now having these emotional issues where you just kind of feel terrible?
He's basically told me that I had the pain so I didn't have to face this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it was truly horrible. Being me was, I wouldn't wish that on anyone. It was so bad. And I think as we got more in touch with what my pain was really about, which was I felt so unloved, I felt unwanted, I felt like a burden, I felt that my only role in life was to take care of other people. It just, that's really painful because as humans, we're wired to be loved, right, essentially. And if we don't feel loved, then it feels almost, there's so much shame attached to that.
Right. Right. Definitely. So, eventually you find yourself out of this. And so you're doing a journaling practice. Is there anything else that you're doing in that realm? Did you continue up a journaling process? Because some people sort of get as far as they can get with journaling and then, you know, just like Dr. Schubiner was on the show a few weeks ago. And one thing that he had said is that basically people can will journal for a long time, but they won't find a solution. It was in response to a question from a guy actually from Jersey. And he had said, I've been journaling for, I think at that point it had been 2, 3, or 4 years or something like that. And Schubiner was pretty adamant that, there's three things that could be going on. One is that you haven't unearthed emotional issues. He's like, it's probably not that. You've probably done enough of that. He said, you may need to make some kind of a drastic life change. He's like, it's most likely not that for most people. He said, you get to a point sort of where you just need to give up and be okay with it and not try so hard. And so what camp were you in to eventually get you out of all these issues?
So the pain kind of went away with journaling plus therapy. The other issues, which I'm pretty much on the other side of everything at this point. It was intensive psychotherapy. We're talking 2.5 hours a week. Plus, I took up a meditation practice eventually. I had to get out of an abusive relationship. I just did a lot of things to try to help myself, but I think therapy was the biggest.
What kind of things were like, and perhaps there weren't even any ahas. Sometimes I think that, therapy, a lot of times it's kind of this almost like slow build where it's sort of making you reframe and rethink about little things a certain way. And then if you were to look at it in its totality over a year or a couple of years, it's a massive difference. But, day by day or month by month, it might be hard to track those kind of things. What were some of the things that maybe you were taught in therapy that gave you the biggest leaps?
I think that one of them is to always be curious about what's going on. If a symptom pops up, there's a reason that it's happening, and to really try to dig into it. And I think I'll speak to a lot of people when I say this, but I really don't like doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so frustrating. I just, when you're in that state of having some kind of symptom that feels different or is persisting, it's like, I just want it to go away. I don't want to think about it. I just want it to go away. And sometimes what'll happen is I'll accept it and I'll stop giving it so much power. But I think that that's kind of the key. Stop giving all of this so much power. It doesn't actually mean anything other than you're having an emotional response to something. That's all. These aren't dangerous. If I know when people are in the pit of despair, they think that things won't get better. But I think one thing that Dan taught me is that these feelings always pass.
Right.
But they feel so permanent.
What's your opinion on like the immediacy of a correlation to a symptom? And what I mean by that is there was a episode back in January with Michelle Hintzberger, who I adore, and don't know if she's listening to this, but if she is, hello, Michelle. And she had had pain for a long, long time. And then got rid of the pain eventually, and she got married, and then her husband passed away, I think 6 days after their wedding, in an accident. All the pain came roaring back. And one of the lessons that she had said that she really walked away from that with is that if she did not have all the tools that she was essentially, you know, that she learned or was given to get rid of the pain the first time, that she doesn't know how Evan passing away would have went, right? It could have went really, really bad if she didn't know that, hey, this really traumatic thing just happened and all this pain then starts. Like, if you're somebody that doesn't know about this work, you may just think that, oh my gosh, my spouse died and then I have all these massive pain issues, and then you go into the spiral of seeing the doctor. So for her, it sounds like the immediacy of a highly charged emotional event happened and then she has symptoms and it was almost immediate. In your experience, both as a patient and clinically, or maybe in practice, I'm not sure what I would use for that. And we'll get into more details later. But is it more like, hey, if I have a symptom now, it must mean that something happened very recently, like in the last day or two? Or are you more of the belief that symptoms are almost this like waxing and waning thing that you may have thought about something that happened 30 years ago and now you're having a symptom again? Like, what camp do you maybe fall more into? Because me personally, I feel pretty strongly that it's much more like, what is going on right now? And what are the issues that I'm thinking about right now, as opposed to unearthing stuff maybe that happened 20 or 30 years ago? And if you disagree, that's totally fine, obviously. But I'd love to get your take on that now that you've been on both sides of the fence.
Sure. I think it really depends. For people like me who have had significant childhood trauma, it could be something that happened 30 years ago. But it's what the present is about the feelings that we're experiencing now. We don't necessarily have to know what is an event that happened, but what we need to be aware of is, okay, what triggered me to feel that way that's causing these symptoms? Because it's trying to distract you from something that's going on inside of you in the present, right? Sorry. So I think that the way I try to get people to focus is to think presently what's happening. When I do TMMS work with people, we don't talk about the past as much. We kind of try to focus on the here and now symptoms. And if it seems important to go into the past, we can, but you don't need to do that to resolve present day symptoms. But to kind of go back to your question, I think it generally is a present day internal experience that's causing the symptoms, if that makes sense.
Right. That's right in agreement with what I would think is, like, when I think about triggers and things like that, like, let me be very clear, this did not happen. But as you were saying that, I was looking outside and the garbage truck is outside. And I was thinking, like, you know, what if I had an animal, you know, like a dog or something of mine that was hit by a garbage truck and passed away, that happened 20 years ago or whatever, and then I see this garbage truck and then suddenly I get a back spasm or something. That sounds like what you're referring to, a trigger of a past emotional event maybe that did happen 20 years ago, but for whatever reason this is bringing up that same feeling as a trigger. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, awesome. So you eventually work your way out of this pain, right, through a few different practices with therapy and journaling and meditation and a few of these things. Are these still things that you, well, maybe let me back up. So when would you say, like, and I know that Nicole Sachs talks a lot about the element of there's a cure for chronic pain. There's not a cure for human pain, but there is definitely a point where people that are over TMS that an over chronic pain where there was like a ribbon cutting moment where it's like, you know, this is over. Like I'm back to living my life and you know, maybe I have a twinge here and there, but this thing is, you know, this is in the rearview mirror and I'm a different person and I realize things differently and I think about things more critically. But this pain and these emotional issues are over. When was that point for you where it's like the line in the sand has been drawn, you know, the jig is up and I'm good to go now. Maybe you still have some practice stuff that you do on a regular basis, but when did you get to a point where it's like, yeah, this is done?
I think that there are a couple moments. One was when the physical pain went away, that felt really relieving, except then with all the emotional stuff that came up. When I was in the middle of business school, I had a major breakthrough in my therapy when I realized that I had been shutting people out emotionally and sort of how to stop doing that so much. And I felt intense relief. And then I sort of came to this realization that I had always wanted to be a therapist, but I was too afraid of it. I didn't believe that it worked. I didn't trust myself to be able to do it. And then at the end of business school, I decided that I was going to go back to school and become a therapist. So that was a big change because I felt like I was finally living my life based on my values instead of what other people wanted for me. But I was still in a pretty bad place emotionally. I think my big turning point was when I finished school to become a therapist and kind of magically my 20-year battle with anorexia ended.
Awesome. And what year are we at this point with the anorexia?
This is 2018. I had been so frightened. This is the one symptom that I felt that I could never give up because I totally over-identified with it. I think that most people with eating disorders think that their eating disorder is them when it's a defense, it's a coping skill to deal with trauma generally.
Right.
And my therapist said to me one day that he said, you don't have an eating disorder anymore. I was doing all the behaviors that indicated that I had one, but emotionally I could be in my body. So I didn't need that coping skill anymore. So then it just actually went away.
Yeah.
And that was really relieving.
Right. No, that's terrific. That's one thing that I feel like maybe there's been an interview or two that I've done on this show where eating disorders have come up. But so there's it's an unnamed person. I'm not going to use their name. But if they're listening to this, they'll know who they are. There's somebody in one of these Facebook TMS groups that frequently talks about different symptoms. And initially, a lot of the discussion that she had was around symptoms of digestion. Like basically would eat, doesn't matter what it is, doesn't matter when it is, doesn't matter how much it is. She vomits, gets incredibly sick. She's had all the testing done in the world. They can't find anything wrong. You know, there's nothing there. And she had DM'd me one day and we're kind of talking back and forth. And I had asked her, you know, when did these start? And she had said that the digestion issues, I can't remember the exact order of events, but what I believe it was that the digestion issues had started after basically like, it was sometime in high school, I believe, but a lot of her friends had basically didn't want to be her friend anymore. You know, kids get to high school and they befriend other people and then suddenly you're just sort of left there in the dark, and that's kind of how high school goes for some people, unfortunately. But prior to that was a long battle with different eating disorders. And I had said like, okay, I'm not a doctor and you know, I'm not a therapist, anything like this. However, as an armchair quarterback, what I can say is that my observation is that if you had this long history of eating disorders and then the eating disorder went away, and then you've developed digestion issues, really just exchanging one symptom for the other. I mean, does that seem plausible to you, especially given what it is that you've been through?
I want to be careful because I don't know this person and, right, and I'm not totally sure what their history is, but it would sound to me like that could definitely be the same thing. I think that Dr. Guads, do you know who he is?
He's the referring doctor to Dr. Margaret Chan, and she adores him. Yeah.
Dr. Guads lists eating disorders and all kind of stomach issues as TMS. Mm-hmm. And I would tend to agree with him that if that this, it sounds like this person probably might be having some kind of reaction and might be unaware of what they would be feeling. And their digestive system is probably trying to tell them something still, because you can stop doing eating disorder behaviors, but that doesn't mean that you've resolved the emotional issues that were underlying them.
Is there anything to that that you've come across, whether it's any sort of like studies that are done, and even an observation of working with probably so many different patients in the time that you've been doing this? But, you know, one thing that Sarno, Schubiner, Schechter, like pretty much any doctor that's written a book on this says, when they talk about people that come into their office that have back pain or neck pain or knee pain or whatever, one of the questions in an intake form or one of the initial questions they may ask somebody is, do you have a history of any of these symptoms? And it seems like stomach problems are in like the first, like across the board, that seems to be the first symptom that a lot of people develop. And it may even be like they come in when they're 35 with this back pain, but then they're asked, hey, did you ever have stomach pain? And they can think back to that time when they were 18 or 20 or 15 or 25 or, you know, whatever the case is, and they started having digestion problems or they started having different stomach issues. What do you think that is, this connection to, you know, and I can Google this and it'll tell me the vagus nerve and it'll tell me, you know, the brain and gut connection. But from you, I guess, in your experience or your hypothesis, what do you think it is that the stomach seems to be such a vulnerable place for so many people, especially in the beginning?
If I think about it from a developmental perspective, I think that, what do kids say when they're upset?
Well, that my stomach hurts or I feel sick.
Yeah. That's what it is. It's speaking to a childhood type issue generally.
Right.
So I think that's generally what I think about it. I think that maybe I'm a little bit biased because I generally work with adults who've experienced significant childhood trauma, but at the same time, I can't think of a TMS patient that I've worked with that doesn't have some kind of stomach issues.
Yeah, it even seems like it doesn't, like the symptom imperative phenomenon to me, it's like, you know, you have one symptom, that symptom goes away or almost completely goes away, and then you get this other one that's really intense. But it seems like the stomach almost can sit there with people for a long time, and they can experience issues with the gut, but then also experience issues with a shoulder or with a back, or like it almost seems like any imperative can almost be substituted, except for the stomach's almost like this, you know, TMS foundation where it can just sit there and you know, lay dormant for a long time.
It's really funny that you're asking me this, Eddie, because I actually posted in Nicole's group last week about something that happened with me last week about suddenly having IBS symptoms that I haven't had anything like that in a really long time. And then the minute that, and I actually mostly ignored them, but then suddenly I got angry and they went away.
Well, do you think that part of that is that you experienced an anger behind it and then it released?
Yeah, I think that I hadn't been aware that I was angry, and I had noticed I kind of went back and observed, oh, what was going on in that moment? Oh, I guess I was angry. Yeah. Oh, okay. And then actually the release came when I got angry in the moment. I want to be clear that it doesn't have to happen like that. This is just a certain circumstance in my life where it did happen like that. We don't actually have to feel the emotion to get the symptom to go away. It's more of an awareness thing.
Yeah.
But for me, that was kind of a release.
One thing, and I was going to ask you this later, after I asked this question, let's dive into more of you practicing this stuff and, you know, being a therapist and prescribing certain things to certain people on here's what we do and different cases, stuff like that. But one hot button question that I feel like gets brought up a lot recently, or one thing that I am talking to a lot of people about, is this. It's almost like this triad of concepts. So there is emotional repression, but then I think the assumption is that the opposite of repression is expression. So if they say, well, if I come home and I start, you know, bashing walls and stuff like that, then my pain should resolve. To which I talk about my opinion is that the opposite of repression is experience, even though it doesn't seem like that from a vocabulary level. But and then even more recently, I feel like I cannot find the quote. So it may not have even been in his book. It could be in another book. But I thought it was in one of Gabor Mate's books, where he was talking about basically, he was like giving almost the, I shouldn't say he, because I'm not positive he said it, but this person that was writing this was describing a patient at a therapist's office who is experiencing an emotion and they're completely stone-faced. So this isn't crying uncontrollably. This isn't getting anger uncontrollably. It's almost like if you're truly experiencing a negative emotion, it's almost like a poker face and somebody right next to you may not even know because it's all internal. Can you just talk for a minute or two about repression, expression, and experience and how those would all differ in your experience?
I'm a little bit confused about what you're asking.
So tell me about that. So if we know that repression, emotional repression, is really like the root of TMS in a lot of ways, what's the opposite of repression to you as a therapist?
Awareness.
Okay, interesting. So there's another opinion. So talk about awareness being the opposite of repression.
Okay, so when we repress things, they're out of our consciousness, and we're not doing it on purpose. It's just that's the way we've learned based on our past experiences. And repression is a psychological defense. So it keeps something out of our conscious experience because it's too threatening to our conscious experience to have it. So what happens when I work with people is we start talking about how do we bring things to our consciousness? How do we raise our awareness so that I think what's important to what I tell everyone is that once we bring things into our conscious awareness, it's going to feel a lot better to you eventually because you won't be doing things that make you feel out of control, like that your life is happening to you. A lot of the times people have TMS because they just think that things happen to them. They don't think that they have control over things. That's what makes them feel trapped and angry and helpless. So by becoming aware of what your internal experience is, so this sensation that I get in my shoulder, that means I feel angry right now. Okay, that's something that I'm allowed to have in my conscious awareness. That isn't a threat to my existence as a person. Because what happens is our primitive brain makes us feel like all of this stuff is dangerous and a threat to our lives. So what we have to work with is our more developed brain in terms of seeing, okay, these are just sensations in my body. That's all emotions are. So we can have those. We can be present in our body with them and name them and then understand how to behave based on what's happening right now.
So it's almost it's like you're pulling the amygdala out of the driver's seat and putting the prefrontal cortex in the driver's seat, it sounds like.
Yeah.
A little brain geekism, I guess. Okay, so a hard left turn, right? So mm-hmm. you understand this stuff deeply. You understand how to get it out of you. And you probably at this point know yourself so much better than you did 10 years ago, 5 years ago. So now you're practicing this stuff and helping other people get out of pain. So let's start there. I think I can make an inference on why it is that you chose to do the exact field and specific field that you're doing. But in case I'm wrong, tell us why it is that you decided to get into this specifically.
Well, I think that I view myself as a protege of Dan Ratner, and he taught me how to do this, and I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of how to help people with chronic symptoms, and I like doing it. It's very gratifying to see people feeling better.
And what's the Dan Ratner? I'm gonna have to I'm gonna have to get him on the podcast. That's a good idea. so do you two keep in touch, I'm assuming, right?
We're still working together.
Oh, you're still working together. Okay, awesome. So what is maybe some of the techniques that you use now? Like somebody, you know, somebody finds you, or maybe even, because I think sometimes like some people go to a doctor and they, a TMS doctor, they get a diagnosis of this thing and then they get referred out to work with a particular psychologist if the doctor mm-hmm. feels that would be a necessity. But I feel like most of the time people don't go see a TMS doctor because there's not one in their area, myself included. And they go and seek out a psychologist that specializes in this stuff. So you get somebody that comes in the office and say, I've read Dr. Sarno's books. I think I have this thing. I've had this stomach ailment forever. I don't have cancer. I don't have a tumor. I've been tested for those things. I mean, where do you start? It seems so complex, but also it seems kind of like it's kind of simple as well, because if we know that the symptom doesn't necessarily matter all that much, which is what Dan had told you in the beginning, yet the human brain is pretty darn complex. And so what are some of the things you're doing really early on with a new patient or client that's coming to you for help?
A lot of it is kind of convincing the person, because I think it's always the same. It's convincing them that they can feel better. It's calming the anxiety, telling them you are not the only person I've worked with that has had this issue. And it doesn't matter what the symptom is. We deal with it in the exact same way. And although I forgot to mention, I do actually incorporate some somatic experiencing into my work with TMS patients. Do you know what that is?
I've watched Peter Levine do it on YouTube.
Yeah. So I do that a little bit too, just to kind of get people into their bodies and more aware of what their physical experience is, because TMS really actually takes you out of your physical experience. I think that it seems kind of counterintuitive that someone who's in severe physical pain would not be in their body, but they're not.
Right. Because it's almost like a symptom comes and they're saying, don't think about that. Don't think about that. Don't think about that. Don't think about that. And it's just revving up the danger signal. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah. Okay. So then what we do is I tell them the feelings that I listed earlier, and I ask them if they feel that any of those feelings are relevant to their experience. And usually the answer is almost every feeling feels accurate, but there's usually some distress about, but I know what I'm feeling. I already know that. I've done all this journaling. I've done all this stuff. And I try to tell them, yeah, you've done all this stuff, but there's still more to do. I think that it can feel really disheartening to someone that feels that they're at the end of the road and they don't know what to do. But we are such complicated beings that it's hard to totally be able to figure all of this stuff out on your own. I still have to talk to Dan about symptoms that I'm having. Dan has told me symptoms that he's having. It doesn't mean anything bad about you if you're still having them. But I think that I try to quell people's anxiety about that. That doesn't mean that they're going to last forever. We just have to keep talking about what's coming up. And maybe there's something that's still not, you're still not allowing that into your conscious awareness. And that's okay. But I find that the process doesn't actually have to last that long to get rid of the physical symptoms.
That was actually going to be my net. You like, literally grabbed the thunder out of my hand. But for you at this point, because you had said, you know, Dan talks about symptoms to you, you talk about symptoms to Dan. So say you get a symptom right now, whether it's one that you've had before or a new one or whatever, how long does it generally take you before you have sort of thumbed through your brain's Rolodex and figured out, oh yeah, that's the card, or I just have general awareness? Like, to me, that seems like it could be awfully quick. And when I mean quick, to me, it seems like it could be like minutes or hours. Is that inaccurate or is that pretty accurate?
It depends. It depends on how uncomfortable something might be for me. I had shoulder pain a couple weeks ago. It was my birthday. And I sat with that for about a week. And then it resolved, but then it turned into the stomach symptoms. Yeah. So
damn it.
Yeah, I know. It was like really annoying. So I think if the hope I want to instill in people is that the symptoms can go away in minutes, seconds, but it depends on how aggressive you feel like being with the awareness of what you're feeling in the moment, or what I think that that's kind of the biggest. What am I feeling right now? And is that okay? But if I look at it from a somatic experiencing type of option, it's kind of like, okay, what is the cycle that my nervous system is going through right now? And how did I discharge this energy that's trapped? So sometimes I'll do that. And sometimes I'll do my more TMS, what am I feeling approach. But it kind of just depends.
So that's a good question. I was actually thinking about this morning, discharging, because the, it depends on who you ask, but discharging can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. So give a couple of examples of what you mean. You've got this energy stuck in the nervous system. What's the discharge?
So because if we're looking at it from a trauma perspective, trauma is trapped energy in the body that hasn't been able to be discharged. And when I talk about discharge, what I mean is this feeling that's stuck in the body, the person doesn't know how to process it. And it's the same thing. That's why both things are kind of interchangeable. Like, what am I feeling versus what do I need to discharge from my body? It's all emotions, but it's just the way we access them can be different, if that makes sense.
And so one example, you're saying like one example might be journaling. One example might be asking yourself repetitively, like it's kind of each to their own. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. And sometimes I'll do a meditation and try to neutralize whatever the sensation is, because the more less power we give it, the less it'll stay.
Yeah, I always think of it as a, you know, if you're out in the woods in Africa for some reason in the middle of nowhere, and a lion sees you, right? Like, the lion's the threat. You're running. You're scared. You're whatever. However, if you walk right up to that lion and you face it, right, then you're showing it really that there is no threat. And I think maybe sometimes, like, you encounter an animal in the wild, and the advice a lot of times is like, make yourself big, make yourself tough, stand up to it, see it, you know, that kind of thing, which is totally counterintuitive to what we would think is the right thing to do if you're in the wild. So to me, it resembles a lot like that, right? Like, evolution wise, we still interpret these threats like, I have a late bill on my electricity, or my, you know, my boss yells at me, or whatever. Alligator brain is saying, hey, this is a major threat, and you're going to die, so you better run away. And since we can't do that in our lives, a lot of times we get the physical symptoms. It seems like it's really no different. Now, by standing up to whatever that symptom is, which to me in a lot of ways is what somatic experiencing is. Like you said, it seems counterintuitive. However, if the inclination is of us to try and ignore a symptom and don't think about that, and don't think about your stomach hurts, don't think about that your back hurts, that's why it keeps coming. Whereas if you sit there with it and you're just sort of looking at it, the threat seems like it would shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink.
I was just thinking about, I think that something that demonstrates this point pretty well. When I was recovering from anorexia, I had to learn how to eat food, but we are most vulnerable when we're eating and sleeping. So we actually feel that we're under threat generally when we're eating. And so before I would eat, I would have this horrible panic attack. I thought I was dying, and I would just sit there and tell myself, I'm safe, nothing bad is happening, and trying to name what the experience is and just be like, okay, well, so for some reason my body thinks that I'm going to be killed by a tiger right now because I'm eating. So that's not actually happening, and I'm going to get through this. It was awful, but it taught me a lesson about the kind of dual awareness of what's actually going on in reality versus what my internal experience is.
What is, since this question got asked, and I kind of brought it up, I alluded to it a little bit earlier, but Since I had a listener that wanted me to ask Dr. Schumann this question, it might actually just become a mainstay, and I may ask any practitioner, whether they're a psychotherapist or they're a medical doctor. If somebody's been doing what they deem as a daily practice, like journaling or something, for, you know, years on end and not seeing any sort of a change in symptoms, what would you suspect is their missing link to you? If you had somebody that came to you and said, "Julie, I read Dr. Sarno's book, I read Dr. Schubiner's book, I've been journaling for 3 years, I haven't had a change in symptoms. What am I missing? What am I doing wrong?" Right? Because that's the inclination. I'm doing something wrong. What would you suspect is probably the thing that's missing with them?
First of all, they're not doing anything wrong. But I tell everyone that I work with, your pain serves you a purpose. And we have to figure out what that purpose is. And generally, the pain is speaking for someone so they feel that they're allowed to seek help when they feel that they don't want to do that consciously because they feel there's something wrong with seeking help in circumstances when they're not having physical pain.
Yes. All right. Well, so we're getting to the end, and I guess, you know, how can someone get, like, if someone wants to work with you, if someone wants to learn more about you, where is it that they go?
They can go to my website, which is juliemarkowitztherapy.com. I also have an Instagram, which is julie_markowitz_therapy. And I think that we're friends on there.
I follow you. I was just going to say, yeah. I follow you there.
Yeah.
And then do you see, I guess, A, are you taking new patients? And then two, how do people generally work with you? Because in the pain psychology world, it seems like there's a really high number of people that do Skype sessions all around the world. But then also, it seems like some do take them in person if they're geographically able to.
So I will be taking new people in person in San Diego in a couple of months. And I also work with people remotely in a coaching capacity. So wherever they are.
Yeah. 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 Awesome. Well, is there anything, any addition? You've dropped so many knowledge bombs here today. And so are there any little nuggets of wisdom that you want to close with, or anything that maybe we didn't talk about that is on the tip of your tongue? Like, oh, we definitely need to talk about that.
So I think that sometimes what isn't discussed in the TMS world is the effect of internalized oppression that causes some of these symptoms, not just from specific childhood trauma or something, but when I think of pelvic pain specifically, I think that a lot of women have it because of how they're treated in this society and marginalized. And so that's internalized as pain.
I think that you're really on to something. I feel like maybe I've actually heard that said a couple of times. Do you think I feel like we're going to start it, because then another question just came to me, sort of not necessarily related, but sort of related. Do you think that, because you're saying that there's a correlation there between a symptom and the way that, you know, essentially the way that we interpret the world, the way that we're marginalized, things like that. Do you find that there's other correlation with other symptoms, whether it's a shoulder or it's very Louise Hay, but is there any other thing where you think, like, yeah, these particular instances in society or in people's lives tend to manifest as this symptom? Like, is there anything else that you think ties in that same way?
Yes. I think that people who feel that they don't deserve a voice often have throat issues. I think that a lot of back issues are about carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders or your low back. I think there's so many. I had foot pain one time, and actually multiple times, and it was that I didn't believe I could stand on my own 2 feet.
Interesting. I was about to say you didn't think you could kick enough ass, but
yep. <exactly. laughs>
Okay, this is it's a weird question to exit with, but it just came to me. One thing I've been curious about is, because so much to me, I've done three episodes specifically on the concept of fear, and a lot of times when I finish recording those, I always feel like, you didn't nail that one. So I'd love for somebody else to maybe speak about the concept of, I feel like so much of TMS is about fear, and chronic pain is about fear, because it's like we feel a twinge, and for whatever reason, it's almost like we're programmed to freak out about this twinge, and then think about it, and then keep our, you know, keep our fear and our fearful attention on it. There's a lot of people that I know that, to me, I think that they have heavy issues of health anxiety, hypochondria, that kind of thing. Where, if there is one, an intersection of people that have health anxiety where they assume that something is wrong with them a lot, or they assume that they just are somebody that's unlucky that tends to get different injuries all the time, and like a TMS personality, like what? Are those two the same thing, or are they not the same thing? What do you think?
I think they probably are the same thing. I think that health anxiety is just one of those. If we've had a lot of unresolved fear in our life, it's going to manifest in lots of different ways. And as a hypochondriac myself, or maybe recovered hypochondriac, because I don't freak out about that stuff as much anymore, we're going to look for danger in any way. And I think a socially acceptable way is to be a hypochondriac. And it's actually a way that people can feel more connected to other people by having these kind of symptoms, like medical symptoms, so that they can actually seek out connection. Because generally what I think is that most of these symptoms come from feeling afraid of other people and afraid of connection, but not being aware of that.
It is. It's crazy that you say that. I was visualizing in my head just as you were saying that summer, which is ending, but inevitably brings, you know, backyard parties, a lot of barbecues, things like that. And it is wild how many of these I will go to in a summer. And the first, it seems like it's a lot of times with my family, not my immediate in the house family, but you know, cousins and siblings and stuff like that. But I'll go to these, and a lot of times it's like I walk up to a group of people I don't know, and I sort of stand there in a circle. People are talking. I want to like introduce myself or whatever. And sometimes I'm even counting, you know, how long will it take? And usually it's within a minute or less sometimes before somebody starts talking about what pain they're having right now or what pill they take regularly, you know, Lyrica and all this kind of stuff for these different things. And then I walk away because I'm just like, this is ridiculous. And 25 minutes later, I may walk back and it's the same kind of conversation. So people are connecting, but they're connecting in kind of this really strange way. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like it's not exactly the same, but if you're standing in a line at a grocery store or something like that, and people are just so anxious, I feel like, in general. And sometimes I really try and test myself in these situations. So you're standing at a line in a bank or a grocery store or something, and how long is it before that person sets all their stuff down on the counter and waits for their turn before they take out their cell phone and look at something, right? Like just standing there and just chilling. We can't just chill. You know what I mean?
Eddie, imagine that party if someone started talking about, yeah, you know, I really feel a lot of shame for being at this party right now. I'm really worried about what other people think of me, and I don't know how to deal with that. Can you guys help me?
Right. People probably walking away.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, that's I'm such a, I want to do a full episode on this. I just don't understand it quite enough yet, but I'm a big, recently been thinking a lot about the concept of social contagion. And I feel like in situations like that, like there's Steve Ozanich and I talked about this once on this show, but he was saying, it's amazing. If you go up to a group of people and somebody talks about their elbow hurting, suddenly your elbow starts to hurt. And if I'm standing in this circle of these people at a barbecue and someone says, oh, I've got fibromyalgia, oh, I've got this, I've got carpal tunnel, I've got this. And then suddenly, like, your whole freaking body hurts just because you're listening to these people talk about their bodies hurting. You know what I mean?
Yes. Well, Dan says that TMS is contagious, but what I think is contagious is people's unprocessed emotions that they're just kind of spewing out and not actually conscious of or not telling people about them. So I don't know. I think we could do a whole episode on how to better connect when we have TMS symptoms.
God, you stole my thunder again, because I was literally about to say, Julie, this has been a blast. Can we have you back sometime?
Absolutely. I had a wonderful time, and I think you're really smart, and I love the work you're doing.
Thanks, Julie. You can find her, juliemarkowitztherapy.com. Spelling of the last name, it's actually pretty easy, but MarkowitzTherapy.com. And I'll put the link in the show notes. So if you're listening on an Apple device or Spotify or iHeartRadio, if you click info, you can find it there. Thanks, Julie. This has been cool.